This week on the VergeCast, a new Verge laptop reviewer, Monica Chin, joins us to talk about a bunch of laptops, including the Asus Zephyrus G14, Samsung Galaxy Chromebook, the Asus Chromebook Flip, the new one. Julia Alexander joins us to talk about Quibi, that launched this week. And we get into a bunch of stuff, including the new PlayStation 5 controller. That's coming up on the VergeCast now.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at deloitte.com/us/engineeringadvantage.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello and welcome to VergeCast, the flagship podcast of the Vox Media stay-at-home network. See? It's like I'm changing, reorienting the company a little bit. Hopefully Bankoff hears this. Jim, if you're listening, I didn't mean it. I am Neil, I'm your friend. Dieter Bone is here.
I'm your friend too.
Paul Miller is here.
Hello, I would also like to apply for friendship status.
Oh, good. The website is down, Paul. I'm sorry. It runs COBOL. We have a special guest. Monica Chin is here. Hello, Monica.
Hi.
Monica is our new laptop reviewer, a hallowed position at The Verge. How long has it been? You've been with a few months now, yeah?
A couple months, yeah. It started in late January.
All right. And it's been totally normal ever since.
Absolutely.
Super normal new job. A bunch of laptop stuff to talk about. A little later on, Julia Alexander is going to join us. We got to talk about that Quibi launch. It happened. It happened this week, so that'll be fun a little bit later. I want to start, as always, just a quick run-through of what is happening with the coronavirus. There's a lot of coverage. I've heard from quite a few people that they appreciate that our show is not 100% focused on the virus. It's a balance. We're trying to get it right. Keep giving me notes. I do appreciate it. But I do want to start with just some updates. So first of all, I'm just going to do it because, I mean, they announced it on a Friday and the show comes out on Friday. It's just, I'm good at counting, you guys. It has been 4 weeks. By the time you listen to this, it will have been 4 weeks since Donald Trump had the flow chart that said website, symptom checker, drive through. You know what I'm talking about. And then Google was going to, it was approximately 170,000 Google engineers. We're going to build them a website that let you schedule a test, drive through a test, and get results. That website, 4 weeks, has not shown up yet.
That's correct. However, Verily, the sister company to Google underneath parent company Alphabet, has expanded to another testing site in the Bay Area. And I believe I read that they said that they had done as many as 6,000 tests, which is...
That's good.
I don't know, 600 more than I thought they had. So it's a lot. No, it's actually like more impressive than I expected.
The goal is more tests. If Verily can roll that out even farther, we will do nothing but applaud them. The idea was that everybody would be able to just like use this website, and that is definitely not true.
Speaking of counting, you can also now count the number of days since New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said that Google was going to make him a website for New York State. So
I was going to ask how many days, because you're so good at counting, it's been since he held up a printout of Google tweets and then Mike dropped it, because that's that's my holiday.
That's the one that you're counting from?
I think that was the following Monday. Yeah.
Yeah. There was no promise associated with that. Days since Donald Trump holds printout of tweets is a good, I applaud the timeline if someone wants to keep it. I'm more of the lost promises. So there's that. There's some crazy second order things happening. Chris Welch had a story about webcams just being impossible to find because everyone's working from home. Like a basic Logitech webcam that normally sells for $50 is like $200. Like the C920, the higher end ones, like the Brio, which is their 4K webcam, $500.
Oh my God.
Online. There are some in stores. The problem is that the stores are closed. So Best Buy will like happily tell you they have them in stock in your local store, but only certain Best Buy locations have the curbside pickup that you need. So those stocks are down. We actually got a statement from Logitech. They are not happy about the price gouging that's happening. So where they can, where they have the ability, they are actually trying to get some of those listings taken down. But if you just like bought a bunch of webcams and are reselling them, Logitech can't do anything to you. So that's a weird second order. No one expected it. A bunch of other stuff like Elgato Stream Link boxes. People are using like they're like all sold out everywhere. That's a weird second order one. Addy wrote a great piece about chloroquine and sort of the misinformation ecosystem about that. Just check that out. We're trying to write some servicey things so people have can share reliable information. So that's a good one to share. There's the insane 5G coronavirus conspiracy theory out there. I don't even know what to say about it, but Tom Warren wrote a great debunk of that. People in England are lighting 5G towers on fire. And so like the government and English wireless companies are having to beg people to not light cell phone towers on fire because they're...
This is Britain, so they're politely asking.
Well, they use bold in the press release.
Yeah, are the fires polite fires?
I mean, that is nuts. John Cusack tweeted that 5G would be the root cause of it, and then like everyone dunked on him, and he had to delete a tweet. Like, it is a more pervasive conspiracy theory than you would ever expect. So Tom Warren wrote a debunk of that. I encourage you to go find it and share it widely and get some good information on the world. And then this is just my favorite one, Ashley Carman. The Unicode Consortium has paused emoji development for this year because of the virus. And they're like, look, everyone's really distracted. We don't need to do this.
Do they do in-person meetups to like make the final decision?
Yeah.
It's a completely remote process. You like send like I think The Verge did a piece on how I got an emoji into the emojis.
Jay wrote it, and there is a meeting that like you go and you present, or like you send in your thing, and then there's a meeting where they like go through the presentations.
Can I just read you this quote? It's just from Mark Davis, president of the Unicode Consortium, and I actually appreciate this quote. I'm just going to read it to you, and it's amazing. Under the current circumstances, we've heard that our contributors have a lot on their plates at the moment. And we decided it was in the best interest of our volunteers and the organizations that depend on the standard to push out our release date. People are busy. There's a lot of anxiety in the world. But the ones that were already announced, like the Olive, the Beaver, and the Plunger, they're still coming.
Oh, good.
It's the new ones that aren't coming.
The controversial ones.
Yeah, emoji drama is going to have to wait for a year. Speaking of counting, here's the thing I've been counting the most. On Sunday, April 12th, it will have been 1 year since Foxconn told us that their empty buildings were not empty and that they would send us a correction.
Yeah.
1 year. They've gone 1 year without sending us that correction. So we'll do something about that. You're listening to us on Friday. Yeah. I assure you The Verge will have a post on Sunday to mark this glorious, extremely disappointing anniversary.
The buildings are probably empty right now.
Foxconn actually still under construction in Wisconsin. They deemed themselves essential. To make what? No one knows. But they didn't announce. The CEO of another company, Medtronic, announced that they would be building ventilators at the Foxconn factory in Wisconsin. Foxconn, when reached for comment, declined to comment. So hopefully this factory, which I would remind you is supposed to be making LCDs, will be making ventilators. Medtronic, this is cool. They open sourced their ventilator design.
I'm so stoked on this.
Yeah, Medtronic's a serious company.
Yeah, Medtronic is the real deal. Their CEO says we're going to make them at this factory in Wisconsin. People believe him. He's not screwing around. And they open sourced that ventilator design, so that's really cool. Foxconn has just not committed to doing it. Like, you'd think they would that's like the easiest one in the world, right?
Wait, are you saying Foxconn won't do this or it hasn't agreed that this is the case?
Medtronic CEO went on CNBC and he said, we're going to be making ventilators at the Foxconn factory in Wisconsin. Okay. Reuters, CNBC reached out to Foxconn. Foxconn didn't comment. And I'm saying, like, usually, like, when someone hands you the ball and then picks you up and holds you over the basket, you're like, you just put the ball through the, you know, it's like, it's just like an instinct that companies have, and they just didn't do it. So we'll see. They say 4 to 6 weeks. Again, that is not what the factory is for, though, right? The factory is theoretically for LCDs, and it's supposed to open in May. So we're going to – there's a lot coming on the Foxconn story, but if they do make some ventilators there, I think that's a good thing. It's just – you would think the factory that's supposed to start spitting out LCDs in May was kind of like
– ready to do that. Yeah.
It seems unlikely that you can – like the car companies that are making ventilators, Sean O'Kane is actually going to have a big story on this. Hopefully by the time you're listening to this, Sean O'Kane will have a story about why, like, the state-of-the-art in ventilator tech and why specifically car companies are shifting to ventilator production. It's because they already make HVAC systems. They have a lot of motors. They have huge supply chains, all this stuff. So they can kind of like quickly put one together. There's a really, do you see the Tesla video where Tesla engineers are talking about how they designed a ventilator using mostly Tesla parts? Like, that stuff is cool. Hmm. You don't normally think, because it's all mechanical. It's, I mean, it's basically just a big pump, right? TVs are not big pumps. This is as far as I know. If you can think of a TV that's a big pump, you just hit me up. But
I mean, they're pushing out pixels, and, you know, light and matter are technically, according to the theory of relativity,
it looks like there's a screen related on the Medtronic, and you got to build like a shell for it.
Yeah, sure. Two things you could build. So we'll see. Anyway, Sunday is 1 year since they told us the buildings were empty, and then we'll see if this thing. So that's the Foxconn update. Okay, that is all the more virus news that I got. Just, I want to make sure we keep calling out our coverage, particularly the Verge Science team, which is just cranking away, and then the second order effects that are happening throughout the whole world, quite frankly. So I don't want to shortchange it, but I have heard from quite a few people that everybody needs a break. So we're going to try to get the balance right. Give me that feedback. All right, Dieter, Monica, Paul. Let's talk about some laptops.
Yeah.
The Asus ROG, parentheses, Republic of Gamers, Zephyrus G14 has this hot shit new AMD chip, which we have talked about before. And Eli interviewed CEO last week. Monica, tell us about this laptop.
Yeah. So this laptop was really, really impressive. It's pretty light. It's a lot lighter than most gaming laptops, especially, you know, traditionally gaming laptops have been like 5 and 6 pound things. This just weighs just over 3.5 pounds. And for such a light machine, it really can fly. I was able to play Red Dead Redemption 2 on Ultra, which is just about the like most demanding game you can play. And it was able to do it. Like, it wasn't amazing. It was a, like, you know, a console-ish like experience. But it, you know, you could play it on those settings. But if you play it on high settings, which is just below Ultra, it absolutely was a great experience. It was around 50 FPS. Like, it was really, really, it performs very impressively. And I mean, that's not necessarily surprising. It also has a very powerful graphics card, but it was really impressive to see just the load that it could take on.
So put this chip in context, because this is not the sort of chip that I should expect to like be in the next MacBook Air, right? Or be in the next like Dell XPS. This is like specifically designed for like high intense, high end gaming, like really serious sort of processor work.
Yeah. So the 4900HS, it's an 8-core chip. It's comparable to Intel's Core i9. So, you know, most like Dell XPSs that you're buying are going to have an i5 or an i7. That's what most people are choosing between. When you get into the i9 and 4900HS territory, that's where stuff starts to get pretty like more expensive, more sort of power user oriented. And the HS, the S at the end indicates like special. It means that it's, you know, the 4900H is like the top of the line. The 4900HS is designated more for thinner laptops that can still deliver on gaming. They call it desktop class gaming. So that's the intent of that chip.
A lot of the comparisons I saw was this chip at 35 watts versus Intel at 45 watts. So it's like more, it's kind of comparable power, comparable performance with less power draw.
Yeah. That's definitely what they're going for. But it's obviously not as low powered as the U series, which is that sort of the main like comparable to that's what you're gonna find in ultra portable laptops is the U series. This is the H series, which is for slightly bigger machines that are slightly more powerful.
Oh, and so my big question is the battery life, because I feel like AMD was able to make laptop processors in the 3000 series that were cheap and ran okay. And this is very fast and a little more expensive. So what's the battery life? Is it a win?
Yeah. Oh, the battery life is definitely a win. That's sort of another thing. Like the last Zephyrus we reviewed back in 2017 had like 2 hours of battery life. Like it was almost comical how irrelevant the battery was. I got out 8 hours and 50 minutes of browsing. You know, not gaming, but you know, on a balanced battery profile, so not even in battery saver mode. It easily made it through a whole workday. And it only took 41 minutes to charge up to 60% on Asus's plug, which is like, that's not terrible. And even gaming on battery, I got about an hour and a half on a charge. It's a pretty big accomplishment for such powerful hardware to last that long.
Put this thing in context. Like, this means a lot to gaming laptops, and I'm assuming as like thinking about gaming laptops, this is not going to be a one-off. This is actually like going to be a new thing that the Intel and AMD continue to fight over. Does this affect anything that's going on with laptop processors outside of that specific domain?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely hope so. I think that, you know, even though this is a machine intended to be for, you know, intended to be for gaming, it's certainly something that works really well as a productivity machine as well. You know, it handled the multitasking just fine. Obviously, you know, the 16:9 aspect ratio isn't like the one that I'm certainly a fan of for productivity, but I certainly would, you know, I would be totally happy having this as my primary device, you know, work device as well. And I think that's one of the things that is really impressive about this chip is it, you know, it's able to provide the battery life necessary that most people are looking for in a primary device while also really like enable it to run games. And so I feel like I could just have this and I wouldn't need a secondary productivity device if I wanted to use this to play games. I would hope that even laptops outside of the gaming space, I think Intel's really been put on notice here. I think not just with gaming laptops, but with, you know, I think this really shows that laptops can be really powerful gaming laptops and really good productivity devices, where the battery life and where the power consumption and the design and the weight is concerned. So I hope that Intel is making moves to do that and is moving in that direction too.
So Monica, I mean, that like sets us right up for like the other part of the conversation here, which is AMD has been charging hard. They're doing well. This is a solid machine with a powerful chip in it. That's next to all of the 10th gen stuff we're seeing Intel put out, which seems a lot iffier than I expected. Is that kind of your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it, you know, definitely compared to the prices that we've seen for Intel stuff so far and the, you know, the battery life and all those things that we've seen for Intel so far, I would say, you know, for comparable gaming machines, the Zephyrus G14 has really rewritten the rules. When I first saw the price, $1,449, I was like, I literally emailed the PR guy and asked if that was the right price. That seemed so low to me for the specs that this thing has and the performance it was putting out. I really think they've raised the bar a ton, and in terms of what Intel machines should be able to do at that price point. I mean, that's like unprecedented in terms of what I've seen.
So, okay, if we're talking 10th gen Intel, we actually, maybe it would be useful to like do Intel chips 101, because like when it used to be like, you, if you knew between Y series and UC series and Intel, you were good. And then like, you kind of needed to know about the gen. But now when I hear Intel 10th gen, like I literally don't know what it means. Like it could literally mean anything. it's confusing as hell. So like there's this new XPS you reviewed a couple of Chromebooks. Everything is like running Intel 10th gen, but it seems like none of this stuff is actually equivalent. So like, can you like just give me this dummies version of what's going on with Intel 10th gen right now?
Yeah, so in terms of the current XPS that I'm reviewing has the i7-1065G7, and that is part of the Ice Lake generation.
Okay.
This one is a quad-core processor. The XPS 13 that we reviewed at the end of last year has an i7-10710U. That's of the Comet Lake generation. And so that one is a six core processor. So I think that's sort of the main, the big distinction that I'm, you know, that our reviews have sort of been looking at. So, you know, something with two extra cores is going to be a better fit for productivity oriented tasks, stuff like crunching numbers, elaborate things in Excel. But we found Dan found in his review, of the one at the end of last year, which has six cores, that it was worse at things like photo and video editing, because the update with the Ice Lake processor is that it actually has better graphics, better integrated graphics. And so one of the things that the XPS 13 that has come out with the Ice Lake chip is that is supposed to be a much better one for gaming on integrated graphics.
So you're currently reviewing the XPS 13. I don't want to spoil your review. I think it'd probably be out after people listen to this, but what is your early impression?
Yeah, I think my early impression is that it's very good. I mean, the XPS 13, you know, for the past several years has been really the Windows laptop to beat. Just, you know, I think that if you took a lot of the features that it has, like if you took the keyboard, if you took the touchpad, if you took the design, if you took the performance, and you just put that by itself in like another laptop, it would be the standout feature. It's a really cool experience to just have all these features be like absolutely the best, basically. I think that over the past couple of years, the XPS 13, the progression has really been one of refinement. It's been Dell sort of seeing like what is like the one or two things here that people really don't like and changing that. So, you know, for a while it was the nose cam and for a while it was the bottom bezel. I think they're really at a point where they've fixed a lot of the things that we didn't like. I think it's probably still the laptop to beat.
Okay.
That nose cam thing is really funny because there's an argument in my Twitter replies today about webcams. And like, there's just a bunch of older XPS 13 owners being like, I didn't think it would go this bad for me.
I was on a Zoom call with a guy with a nose cam. And it was just hilarious.
That was always the reason I didn't want to buy it was the nose cam. I mean, that was literally like, it seemed like the one kink in the armor.
If you don't remember, for the people listening, if you don't remember it was like 2 years ago, Monica, that the XPS 13, the camera was like in the bottom of the screen in the corner. And so it just like shot up your nose.
And I would also say the other big thing is the design has changed a lot. There's the screen is taller. So the 16:9 aspect ratio is gone. And I hate the 16:9 aspect ratio. The eliminated bottom, you know, the bottom bezel used to have the big Dell logo in case you forgot that Dell made your computer. So and I think, you know, it really looks different. And I'm really excited for everyone to see how it's changed.
Okay, so we got to get to NVIDIA stuff. But before we get there, I need to express my deep, heartfelt, emotional sadness about the two Chromebooks you just reviewed. So like, 10th gen in the XPS sounds good. 10th gen in the Samsung Chromebook and the Asus Chromebook Flip, it sounds like not so good. What the hell happened with these Chromebooks?
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue with these Chromebooks is just that they cost too much, you know. And there are lots of debates about does anyone actually want a $1,000 Chromebook? Why would you pay $1,000 for a Chromebook? And I mean, there's definitely a market out there. You know, there are people, there are power users of Google. There are people who really like a Chrome OS ecosystem. It's their preferred operating system, and they really want a really, really nice computer. I've been talking to a lot of these people who have been so frustrated that they feel like their best options are like either you get the Pixelbook or you just have like what looks like junk. So a lot of people have really been waiting for, you know, something that's comparable to an Ultrabook that has Chrome OS. And a lot of them hoped it would be the Galaxy Chromebook or it would be the new Asus Chromebook Flip C436. And, you know, the Galaxy Chromebook looks so nice. It's really well designed. And there's a lot of cool things about the design. There's like a stylus. There's like a camera in the keyboard deck. And the screen, you know, it's a 4K AMOLED screen. It looks absolutely beautiful. And it's a lot of fun to use. And it's super light. But it's just a battery life of 4 hours is really not useful for most people. You buy a laptop because you want to be able to carry it around. You don't want to have it just like sitting plugged in all the time, sitting at your desk, especially when it's so light.
Well, and it also gets wicked hot, which is incredible.
And it has no fans, so that's not necessarily surprising. But yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I think it's, you know, if it were a $500 device, maybe we'd be more forgiving of a battery life. That's bad, but $1,000, you know, that's when we're getting into like, that's MacBook Air pricing. You know, that's when you really are looking for something that is pretty good all around. And unfortunately, the Flip C436 sort of fell to a similar issue. You know, the battery life wasn't quite as bad. I got about 5 hours out of that, but it's an $800 Chromebook, and you really want an $800 Chromebook to be like significantly better than Chromebooks that are $550 to $650. And I just think, you know, we have the Pixelbook right now. We have the Flip C434. We have Windows machines that are, you know, in that price range or a little bit higher as well, that just don't have the same battery life issue, have similarly good performance, and much, much better battery life. So I think at this point, it's just, you know, we need to make these machines better, or we need to get the costs down.
I have a conspiracy theory. I have a correlation not a conspiracy theory. Mm. I have an unfounded correlation. You just reviewed two machines, 10th gen processors. The Galaxy Chromebook, I think you got 4 hours and change. The Chromebook Flip, you got 5 hours. I just reviewed a MacBook Air with a 10th gen processor. When I ran Chrome, I got about 5 hours of battery life. There's a commonality here, which is Google Chrome, which it just destroys battery life. Like, if you make your entire operating system Chrome, you can't be like, the battery's going to do great.
So one thing is that with the Chromebook Flip C436, as well as with the Galaxy Chromebook, is other reviewers who did battery tests where they just looped 1080p video got way better battery. So I actually do think it's probably an issue with web page optimization or with app optimization. The problem I have is no one is buying a Chromebook just to loop 1080p video.
There is this aspect. It seems like Intel's integrated graphics are getting better faster than their shipping processors are.
But I don't know, dude. Is it just Chrome?
See, Chrome actually does okay when it's we're just running on Linux. There are Chromebooks with good battery life. They exist. The Pixelbook Go is actually a really good example of a Chromebook with pretty good battery life. When it came out, I was like, "Nah, this seems fine," but the other Chromebooks are cheaper and better. It's like the Asus 4C434, which is still around, is just a better all-around computer. But now that I'm seeing this new Galaxy Chromebook, which is literally the successor to the Pixelbook that Google pretty much told me so, it's trash. This 436 is a bummer. I'm actually less worried about Chrome OS in terms of Chrome killing battery than I am about the fact that Android apps are still trash on Chrome OS.
We can't do that. We can't do this. We cannot do this.
But Monica had so many problems.
I have another conspiracy theory, and this is more germane. Okay, when the Galaxy Book S or whatever it's called, was announced, it was announced with a Lakefield processor. And now it's shipping with a common, like Lakefield is like these, I don't know, maybe I'm crazy, but these seem like laptops that maybe were designed like they were going to get a mobile-esque processor from Intel, like a next-gen Qualcomm killer. And then instead they got Comet Lake 14 nanometer plus processors.
Yeah, that's not unreasonable.
See, more conspiracy theories. All right, Monica, what's next? Obviously, your XPS review is coming. What's next in the world of laptops for people looking? It seems like this is a big inflection point, right? You got two new classes of chips out. You got many more, obviously, a flood of new products. What are the next big releases people should be looking for?
Yeah, so we had the big announcements earlier this month were Comet Lake H coming from Intel and NVIDIA's new RTX Super GPUs. And so, alongside those two announcements, we got just a barrage of new laptops that various manufacturers are announcing that are going to incorporate the two chips. The most exciting one to me is the 2020 Razer Blade 15. That's going to pair the RTX 2070 Super Max Q or the 2080 Super Max Q with a 10th Gen i7. So, and it's actually going to be the first 8-core processor to ever appear in a Razer Blade. So very excited about that. So that's gonna be interesting to compare to the ROG Zephyrus G14. That's I think the first time where we're really gonna see how these and that's gonna be an i7, not an i9, but I think it'll still be interesting to see how these systems compare and how well handles the games. Because it's $1,599, so it's only a little bit more expensive. Yeah. Acer's Triton 500 is another big one, getting the super cards. A couple other big ones from Gigabyte, the Gigabyte Aorus 15G and 17G. And then one that I think is really funny is the Asus ROG Zephyrus Duo 15, which is a gaming laptop that has two screens. So there's one in the keyboard, and then there's the main screen, and the one in the keyboard tilts up. I think it's at 13 degrees. So you can have sort of these two screens running at once. So for example, you could be playing your game, and then you could have your Discord chat open on the second screen. We'll see if it actually is practical or useful when we get the device in.
Is it funny or is it genius?
Paul's the founding member of the keyboard in the front club, Monica, if you weren't aware. So,
Monica's new.
The thing that stands out to me with this NVIDIA launch, and I think it's important context with the AMD, is that AMD is not getting all these fancy new NVIDIA cards. Intel and NVIDIA co-announced all these laptops. There's like, you can get a $1,000 laptop with an RTX 2060, which might be comparable or even, I don't even, possibly even better than the AMD laptop when it comes to just gaming. Anything that's like GPU bottlenecked. The really interesting thing is NVIDIA's doing this, like that power shifting thing that AMD was talking about. If the GPU senses that the CPU is the bottlenecked, it will reduce its power consumption so that the CPU has more room to work to catch back up, in a sense. Which, and there's NVIDIA's claiming like maybe 10 to 20% performance gains from that. So even though these are like kind of minor tweaks to the cards, the way that they actually work might actually result in some decent gaming results, which is going to be great news for Intel because they're not helping make these H series laptops that much faster.
Yeah. Also, I want to last on our list in terms of form factor stuff, Monica, you brought up the dual screen stuff that's happening. Microsoft has reportedly delayed the Surface Neo, which I was very excited about, which was their dual screen, which means I don't know what that means for Windows 10X, which was supposed to run all the dual screen stuff, but we will see. Pandemic. It's just happened. It's all my form factor dreams are going away. Okay. Monica, thank you so much for joining us. We'll have you back very soon. It sounds like there's many, many more laptops for you to review and talk about.
Absolutely.
That was great. Good talking to you. All right, we're going to take a break. Thanks to Monica. We're going to come back with Julia Alexander, talk about that Quibi.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. Here's the story of innovation told in 5 words. Try. Explore. Connect. Pivot. Transform. See what happened there? As soon as Connect entered the story, innovation became achievable. That's why Deloitte works with clients and tech alliances to bring together the people, ideas, and technologies to overcome, solve, and of course, transform. Connect to what matters for innovation. Start at Deloitte.com/US/innovate.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Julia Alexander, welcome.
Hello.
I've been so excited for this day to talk to you about Quibi. It launched. It happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's successful in that regard. It's not vaporware.
Well, you know, we've talked about it in conceptually for what appears to be 5 years. We sat through a CES demo of nothing. We have done all kinds of coverage. I encourage everybody to read Liz Lopato's profile of Meg Whitman. Liz had a great idea to not focus on Katzenberg, but Whitman, who is actually the CEO of the company and had to literally change all of their plans and modeling around the virus. It's like just a fascinating story. I mean, the one question that Liz and I were both like, can we ask this directly? It was like, you were the CEO of HP. You're a billionaire because you're the CEO of eBay. You like were the Republican nominee to be the governor of California. Mm-hmm. Why are you running Quibi? we were like, it's pretty rude to ask. but it's launched. After all of that, after all this conversation, it's here. What do you think, Julia?
It's an app in that it opens when I want it to open and it plays videos. I mean, Quibi is exactly what they said Quibi would be. It's short shows and movies and chapters, and it turns, like, there's the function that when you turn your phone, what you're seeing, the format or the aspect ratio or whatever changes. That there's nothing else, I think, to say positively about anything on that app, but it works the way we wanted it to, so congrats.
Have you had an exciting a portrait to landscape or vice versa moment?
I genuinely don't use it unless I remind myself that it's a function that I should use, like when writing about it, so that way I can be like, I've used this and it's here's what it is. But everyone I keep talking to, both in media and outside of media, because Quibi is like a very media thing. People in media love Quibi, and everyone outside of it is like, what is Quibi? That is the world that I experience. So the random people that I've gotten to download the app, because I'm like, please, you're not in media, and I just want to talk to someone who's not in media about it, they haven't used it either. They're like, oh, I don't turn my phone, because no one turns their phone when they're watching anything. That's not what humans do.
The turnstile thing really stresses me out, and I did not expect this, but if I'm watching it in portrait, I'm like, oh, I wonder what I would see if I turned it in landscape. I'm missing something. So then I turn it to landscape, and I'm like, but maybe this would be better in portrait. I wanted to see it in portrait. And so I always feel like I'm like not getting the right thing all the time, because there's two possible options, and maybe I've picked the worst one. I don't know. So I always feel like there's a better version of it that I'm just not seeing.
Have you tried watching it with two phones at one time?
Double quibbing.
I could watch it twice, but there's only so many times I need to see, you know, the reboot of Punk'd. So
if you haven't 2x quibbed, I don't know what you're doing.
Dieter, I feel the same way though. Like, Dieter, I've gone back and rewatched something twice just out of, because I'm concerned I've missed something or it's better a certain way. And that's just is.
Watch it in landscape. That's it. Not,
no.
Here's what I would say. If I had to, like, very narrowly pick two criticisms of Quibi at launch. There are more, but if I did narrowly in like their strategy, I would say one, they do not have the one thing everybody should watch.
Yeah.
Right. They just couldn't pick one. They have a lot of things, like just an overwhelming array of things. I need to disclose, Polygon has a show called Speedrun, which, if you have Quibi on your phone, you should go watch it. There have been some talks about us doing a show. Maybe it'll work out. I don't know. There's your disclosure. But they have a lot of things. None of them are the thing, the way The Mandalorian was the thing. And I know Katzenberg is like, whatever, it's a big hit show. They got all this IP. You can still just pick one, right? When Netflix was going to do original content, they just were like, House of Cards, it's the thing. Everybody go watch the show. They don't have that. So that's like, I would issue that criticism of their launch strategy. The second one is they spent all of this time talking about their technology and what they could do in storytelling on a phone, and literally none of the launch things take advantage of that stuff. Like 0% of them, as far as I can tell. Like, yes, you can turn it, you can watch it in two different, but I watch everything in landscape because it is obviously that is the primary edit of the thing.
You think so?
In every single thing that I've watched so far, it's obvious that the landscape edit is the first edit, and the portrait is like, it's along for the ride. It's not, you're looking at, what, Julia, it's like a horror movie, right? Where you like, in landscape, you're watching the character, and in portrait, you're like watching your screen or something.
Yeah, they like change the way you, but you're still viewing the same type of content. It's just a different POV.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Like, that was like the big promise, right? Of like, you could watch the murderer, or you could watch the person who's going to get murdered. Quibi, by the way, also obsessed with death.
Yeah.
So much. I keep asking them about this, and they keep telling me I'm obsessed with their, like, my own obsession with their obsession with death. And I'm like, no.
So we'll get to that in a second. But the promise was you in portrait, you'd watch the murderer, and in landscape, you would watch the murdery. That's a word. And none of their shows right now do that thing. So, like, if you add those together, they should have had the one big show that fully took advantage of the technology, right? The Steven Spielberg show that only plays after midnight wherever you are. That was the promise. They don't have that yet. And I think that's like, they seem to be doing fine, Julia, right? Didn't they have like a bunch of downloads?
Yeah, so the third party app, so Quibi hasn't announced anything officially. When like Disney Plus launched, they came out 24 hours later and said, we hit 10 million, because that's a great number. Quibi did not hit 10 million. They didn't even hit 1 million. So third party apps came out, like App Annie and Sensor Tower, and they said, estimating about 300,000, which is not terrible for an app that, one, is supposed to be used on the go and no one can go anywhere. two, that doesn't have a strong presence outside of, I would say, like, either very young circles because their advertisements are like super tied into TikTok and Instagram, or you're in media, which like is where the Quibi story I think really truly lies for a lot of people that I know. So 300,000 is not terrible for what Quibi, for what I think Quibi was going to hit. I mean, it's also not a million, and I don't know what internally they wanted to hit day one. But as you said, there's nothing in there that's really... The funny thing about Katzenberg that I think about a lot is that he always says content is a kingmaker, but platform is king. And it's like, but you didn't get the content right, and you also didn't get the actual usage of the phone right. So nothing that you have is king or kingmaker. So I don't know what the business plan is at this point to get to those points.
In Liz's profile, Whitman, again, just go read it because it's good. But like, imagine you're the CEO of a new platform. I'm sure many Vergecast listeners could imagine themselves as such a thing. I would say pull over in your car, but like you're at home. So like just go, I don't know, stand in the bathroom or something. But like imagine you're the CEO of a platform and you're like, I got to launch this platform. And all of your plans, your entire team, your whole company is like, we're going to launch with a big fancy party full of celebrities and then a blitz of ads, expensive ads during March Madness and the Master and all this stuff. And all of it is gone. And Whitman's quote to Liz was like, we're taking those budgets and we're putting them on like Twitch and YouTube. And that's why you just see like, if you're like the number of Quibi ads on Instagram are like out of control. Right. And it's like, yep. Because they took their like broadcast sports ad budget and just fire hosed it at social platforms, which is wild. Like I don't think it's ever been done before that level of move. And like, maybe it worked to get to the 300,000. I think the big question is, will it sustain at that level or is it going to drop? Because it usually drops. And what's it going to plateau at? And is that going to be enough to sustain them?
I mean, that's absolutely the biggest question. And unless they have a show that's going to bring people in, one that they think, unless they have a Game of Thrones or a Mandalorian that people are like, okay, I'm going to sign up for and I'll watch this weekend or week out or whatever, people aren't going to come to it. And especially after 90 days, they're not going to pay $5 for something for content that they can get elsewhere, really, in terms of quality. But the other thing that Quibi really missed out on is that Quibi thinks that it's the reason people will sign up for it are the kind of top high production movies and chapters, big actors and TV shows. And that's not. People are going to sign up to watch food explode in people's faces or watch Idris Elba take on stunt drivers. Like, it's the really funny mid-tier reality shows that Quibi, like basically the 30 Rock fake shows that Quibi has actually produced. Those are like the shows that Quibi will find its audience with. And there's no way to share any of that. There's absolutely no way to talk about Quibi and the ridiculousness of it in like a screenshot or anything because Quibi has disabled any form of sharing, which is absurd.
Yeah, actually, can you dig into that a little bit more? Yeah, like because with Netflix, like people, I watch on TV, but everybody else seems to watch on their laptop because they're able to put out screenshots like really fast with like captions on the bottom. And I'm always like, how do they do that? Oh, because they're not watching on TV. But you can't watch Quibi on TV at all. You just watch it on your phone. So what's the problem?
The greatest series of so I have like a Slack group and it's people who review stuff. It's a bunch of critics. So there are a lot of people who are doing Quibi. And the number one conversation in the Slack was how to get it to like AirPlay on your TV. Like every single person was trying to find a way to figure out a way to do it. And then I thought, oh, that's what critics do. And then when I was on Twitter, just looking at, I have a bar open for Quibi conversation on TweetDeck. It was just it was just like Ariana Grande stands being like, I want to watch this on my TV. Is there any way to Chromecast it? And I was like, oh, that's a surprising thing. But yeah, so I know like when I watch Netflix, my thought process is like, I'm watching this and also I want to get some cool social media points. So I'm going to wait for a good screenshot opportunity and then I'm going to screenshot something and tweet it out. And that's how Tiger King became what it was. Like Tiger King was just people screenshotting and being like, LOL, quarantine mood. And that becoming like a viral thing. Same thing with Mandalorian. Like people screenshotted and tweeted about Baby Yoda like 2 million times or something in like 2 weeks. It became a viral sensation. And with Quibi, because it's disabled on mobile, which is true for a lot of other streamers, like you also can't screenshot on mobile. Without the desktop component, there's absolutely no way to share any aspect of the shows. You're reliant on Quibi's own social media presence or the Instagram accounts of people in Quibi shows. Like if they upload something, I've seen a lot of people screen record and then tweet those out. And it's like that is counterintuitive to what your whole thing is. If you're designing for mobile and what people do on mobile outside of viewing content is like sharing with people, and you can't share, that's the most unfriendly mobile experience I can think of.
Yeah, you know, it's wild to me that Netflix seems like fairly enlightened about this, right? Like they know that screenshots are like your story has a chart of Tiger King views over time and it just explodes, right? Like that's the day it went viral and that there it is. Like it seems like Netflix, you would not expect Disney to know it, but it seems like Disney knows it too, that like we need people to take this stuff, remix it and share it in the ways that they want. That's going to drive a bunch of awareness and be the sort of like user marketing campaign that that makes everything successful now, right? You need to feed the fandom, basically. Quibi is like, it's weird that they don't know that. It's also weird that they didn't, there's like a million product things you could do to even just make that easier for people or like pre-seed them with clips or screenshots. And they don't seem to know that they need to do that work either, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, it was funny. One of the main questions I had before going in was just talking to people at Quibi. And I said, can you screen record? And they were like, no, we're disabling it. Like, why is that even a question? And I was like, well, because people watch content to share content. They don't just watch it to watch it. It's become an interactive experience. Like if I want to get something out of this. And for me, that's like social clout points for making a really good meme on top of entertainment. and so I was thinking about that. And I was thinking about screenshots. And this is something that people have been asking for years. Like Netflix years ago was like, we know people are making GIFs out of our shows. We know that they're screenshotting and turning them into memes. And by 2018, Ted Sarandos, who's their chief content officer, was like, our whole goal is to just meme our shows and movies before they come out. And that way people have bought into the meme and they're going to come check it out because it's a meme. So they did that with everything. And his argument was, which I think is the issue with Quibi's thinking, his argument was we don't have Disney IP, we don't have Warner IP, and we don't have NBC IP. So we don't have anything that people automatically recognize and are just going to come watch. So we have to create a brand out of thin air. And the only way to do that is social media viral hype. And what Katzenberg seems to think is that if the content is good, people will show up. But the landscape is so oversaturated, everything good is being squished or squashed underneath things that are just viral. Like it can't just be good. You have to be shareable. That's the whole way to get people to watch your thing in 2020.
What about Prince of Egypt 2?
What?
What about Prince of Egypt 2?
Just throwing out ideas.
Are you just like pitching Jeffrey Katzenberg right now? Like in the off chance he's listening?
Prince of Egypt was DreamWorks' big breakout, right?
I mean, well, yeah, and then Shrek.
It was a DreamWorks movie, that's true.
Oh, Shrek was DreamWorks too. Who owns Shrek right now?
I think it's still DreamWorks, so that would go...
Hope it's Comcast so bad.
I actually do think it's Comcast. I think it's NBC Universal.
Julia is correct. DreamWorks is Shrek is owned by NBC Universal.
Do the disclosure.
I've arrived at this place. I must disclose that the Virgis parent company, Vox Media, NBC Universal is a minority investor. There it is. Because we talked about Shrek one time. Oh my God. It's always the nightmare. So at the same time this is happening, Julia, Disney Plus hit a big milestone, yeah?
Yeah, Disney announced yesterday that Disney Plus hit surpassed 50 million paid subscribers with like a big asterisk on it. So like 8 million of those subscribers rolled in from Hotstar in India. A few other million subscribers, for some reason, there was like an issue with them, the way that they were counting, because they were like on the precipice of just signing up. So there's like a weird way that they counted it. But yeah, the point being that Disney is telling investors that its Disney Plus streaming service is continuing to grow. A few important parts of that number. One, when Disney first announced Disney Plus, they thought by 2024, they would hit 60 million subscribers. It is now 6 months since Disney Plus launched, and they've hit 50 million subscribers.
Okay.
So they are they're doing way better than what they thought they were going to do. However, the common rule of business is you don't announce a number unless you're pretty sure you're going to hit it, or at least be around the same point that where you are like a year from now. So I think they lowballed that anyways. But it's impressive. 50 million in 6 months in about 10 countries, I think, approximately, is an impressive number.
I mean, hitting 50 million in 6 months, it sounds like they should put the guy in charge of Disney Plus in charge of the whole company. Just make him the CEO.
Oh, my God.
Rough. Julia, put that number in context. How big is Netflix?
Yeah, so Netflix is 167 million subscribers worldwide. For now, it's probably gone past that because that's we're in a global lockdown and people are watching a lot of Netflix. Those numbers were released the last quarter. And Netflix is about to roll into its earnings season, being very, very pleased with what's going on. And I'm sure they have more. But the other thing, which is what ties into Disney, is that Disney, when Disney Plus came out, both Kevin Mayer, who runs Disney's streaming group, and former CEO Bob Iger said they're not really going to announce numbers outside of earnings calls because otherwise it detracts from otherwise that's all people focus on. The reason that they announced it now is not just because it's $50 million. It's because every other part of Disney's company has taken a massive hit. And they're trying to make investors feel okay as they head into their own earnings season, which is going to be terrible. Like, their forward-looking statement is going to be like, every part of our company, with the exception of streaming, has hit a monumental loss.
Right, because they operate theme parks and cruise ships and a sports network and film productions, all which are on pause as well.
Yeah, everything is on pause. So you're seeing Disney make these kind of Hail Mary plays to get investors to feel okay. They're like releasing random shorts to kind of be like, we still have content that people like. Bob Iger is doing interviews with Barron's and not their CEO, notably. He's going out and being like, no, things are fine. We know things are going to be okay. And they're talking about reopening the parks as soon as possible and taking temperature checks. But the point being is they're saying, listen, our streaming is doing fine. It's growing. We're really happy with it. And I think you're going to see them move a few more movies over to Disney Plus to keep people there, to keep people signing up, keep people subscribed.
I mean, that's the big question. I mean, it's a question for Quibi. It's the ongoing question for Disney Plus is what's going to make you come back and open this app, right? With Netflix, it's like, okay, Tiger King definitely made me open the app. Like, I just saw enough pictures of Joe Exotic to be like, I just need to know what's going on here, right? Disney after The Mandalorian has not had the big breakout hit. I will say that I open Disney Plus every day to watch Toy Story 3 with Max, but I'm also like, I could just buy this movie and cancel my Disney Plus subscription, and it would be effectively the same experience. There's nothing. I'm never like looking for new stuff in that app. Are they going to ramp that library up soon?
The idea was they were going to do that, but then all of their big shows that were going to start hitting in August and September, they got hit with production delays. They don't know what they're doing. Mandalorian season 2 is supposed to be October, and it looks like they'll probably be able to get that done because filming's done. Post production seems like they can do it remotely. But like all the Marvel shows were still finishing things up. So we don't know if like Falcon and Winter Soldier and WandaVision, which are their two big ones coming up, will hit on time. I mean, that's the thing, is like Netflix is at this point where Netflix, because they film all their, they drop full seasons, so everything is filmed by the time that they do trailers and announce things. Netflix has enough content for the next 3 months, roughly. And then they have to start figuring things out. But Netflix is out here dropping new things every single week. And that gives them a huge advantage. Because while everyone is struggling, like while Quibi is producing their daily shows, but everything else is kind of taking a step back. Disney's in the same boat where they are trying to figure it out, but they don't really have any new content. Netflix is the only provider that has new stuff. That said, there are two major streaming services launching in 2 months. We've got Peacock, which launches for some Comcast subscribers next week. And then we have HBO Max next month.
No, man. You're just gonna be on the show every week. That's what's happening here.
But HBO Max will do well because it's got family programming and it's got HBO, and I think people will want to watch Friends if they're still quarantined, and so they'll just buy HBO Max.
just give in. Netflix brought back Community, which is a genius move. It's like, what am I watching the most on Netflix? It's Community right now. Okay, so that stuff is upcoming. What's the next thing? Well, I mean, let me just ask you straight out. Quibi's free for 90 days, right? People should just check it out.
Yeah, I mean, the mid-tier shows are like not terrible. Like the reality shows they're cute. And if it was free forever, I'd be like, this is an app I could probably use. Like, I've used this. I've said this. And Kevin, our features editor, Kevin and I debated about whether or not we should put this in the story. Because I was like, Kevin, Quibi is like a bathroom companion app. Like, it's the best bathroom companion app in the world. And Kevin was like, oh my God, please stop being you for a minute. but like, it's a free app that like has cute entertainment for 7 minutes. For now, it's like, if you sign up now, you get 90 days free. And that's fun to use. The minute that they want to charge you $5 with ads or $8 without ads, it's like, you can just use TikTok and it's more entertaining and it's free and it's like you don't have to pay attention to it. Yeah.
Didn't I read that if you sign up and accidentally like choose the ad option for your free trial, that you're just stuck with ads for the free trial?
Yeah, I've seen some people say that. I meant to actually reach out about that because I was like, that seems, for a free experience, you don't want to give people ads for a limited time if you're trying to sell them on your app. I saw that too.
It's the other thing that was interesting to me is that they, after all that conversation we had last week about Amazon and Apple and in-app purchases and Apple's cut, like they're just giving Apple the cut. Like there's no way to pay for Quibi except in-app purchases. Like they just do not want you to overthink it. They're like, push this one button. Like Apple can take the money. We just need a recurring subscription. Go. Which is certainly interesting.
If you do sign up with Apple subscriptions, you can just sign up and then immediately cancel. And then it'll get canceled at the end of the 3 months, but still work until then. So you don't have to set a calendar reminder to cancel it later.
Oh.
Yeah, that is actually one of the best parts of Apple subscriptions, for sure. All right, well, we'll see what happens with Quibi. At the end of the day, Julia, you think about Quibi more than almost anyone in the world. So it's like Jeffrey Katzenberg, Matt Waitman, and Julia, like top three Quibi thinkers. Julia, thank you so much. We'll see you again for Peacock and HBO Max.
Okay.
Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life. If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes, Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. Not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
Paul Miller.
Hello.
Every week in these troubled times, you provide a ray of stability. A ray of stability? A stability ray. Hold it together. What's it called?
I do a segment every week, and it's called Pop the Stack. Okay. And that's capital P, lowercase o, capital P. And that stands for package on package.
Okay.
So I got, when I was looking into this Lakefield conspiracy, I got really into reading about Lakefield. And I just missed this news. But Intel announced this in 2019. It's still not out. It's obviously delayed. There was like a leak in March of like a benchmark, which is always like, sometimes I feel like these companies do that on purpose as like a little tease, like this is coming soon. But this is a really cool chip because it's got one Ice Lake core, like the Sunny Cove core that Ice Lake uses, and then four small Tremont cores. And those are basically like the Atom processor type. And so like the Athena Chromebooks that just came out are like 15 watt, the ultra portable type of processors. But these are like 5 watt, 7 watt chips that are like supposed to be truly competitive with mobile. And we don't have them, but oh yeah, the pop the stack. This is a 3D architecture. So the cool thing is how we're not going to lose in Moore's law is Moore's law is about the number of transistors in an area, right? But doesn't have any rules against stacking. So you stack chips on top of each other, and they've got the substrate that's what it's package on package. You've got 10 nanometer. Meter chip on top of like a 22 nanometer substrate. It's so cool. 3D chip design, and it's got like RAM built in. It's so exciting, and I just wish we had it.
It's coming.
Yeah.
I promise you.
Pop the stack.
Stacks are popping. All right. A little bit of gaming stuff, some Google stuff. We got to talk about this PS5 controller.
I love it. I love it so much. It is prettiest controller. I don't care what anybody says. It's two-tone white and black. There's a little blue highlight lighter on the ring that you barely see around the little touchpad thing. It looks like a stormtrooper.
It looks like an Xbox controller.
Yeah, well, that's because like you actually like it turns out that like hands have a certain shape, and like Sony finally admitted it. That's the other reason I love it.
This is why I don't like it. It looks like they had a shape. And then they slowly morphed it to be more like hands. You know what I mean? And so it doesn't feel as designed. Like, full disclosure, I can't really play games at all on a DualShock. I'm horrible at it. I've like been more of an Xbox person. But I've always admired the design because it's so artificial. And this just, you know, this just looks like a controller that is designed to hold in hand.
I think it looks like I don't remember who on our team said this, but it looks like a BMW i8.
Mm. Yep, for sure.
I mean, it looks like everything. If you just Twitter search for like PS5 controller, it looks like just the number of things people. It looks like Eve from WALL-E.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. I'm like very. It's a Haim wrote an entire piece about how it's like Sony's most exciting design in forever. We'll see. I'm excited about this console generation. It feels like they're proceeding in like the right. Both of them are proceeding in like the right way. Like they're focused on the right things, which is like playing video games and making playing video games fun.
Yeah.
As opposed to like controlling your cable box over IR.
I love that Sony's refusing to show us what the box looks like. Like people are real mad. Just show us the box. They're like, no, actually don't. Just like up until literally like people go out and buy it and unbox it. And that's when they get to see what it looks like.
Oh,
that'd be great.
Everyone's PS5 looks a little bit different.
It's just a pile of chips and a pile of shoebox. Do you remember that year at CES when Sony announced like their first 4K streaming player? It was like way, way before anything was available.
No.
It was like 5 years ago. It was like Sony's very first. They announced their very first 4K TV, yeah. And then they announced their like 4K player.
It was like a subwoofer size type of
it
thing.
It was a circle. Like it was like a circle, a circle that you were supposed to put in your house. And at CES, it didn't work yet. So the circle was just an empty circle with a light in it. And the actual 4K player was a tower PC that was like shoved under the booth. And their whole idea was like you would buy this circle and overnight it would download the movies for you because they were so big.
Right.
And then when you bought them, all you were really buying was an unlock. I don't really know where I'm going with this, except to say I really hope the PS5 is a circle. Because I wanted that dumb circle so bad, and it was never real.
On the controller, because this is the most we know about any PlayStation 5 hardware, USB-C, it's kept the touchpad, which is a bold move. I'm very intrigued, but I always hope that developers will do something really cool with novel input schemes, and they do it twice ever, and it's fun those times. And the built-in mic is really exciting to me. I think that's going to be really useful for like more casual conversations and stuff.
Headphone jack.
It's got a headphone jack?
There's a headphone jack, which is, you know, if you want, you know, lag-free audio, what do? You use a headphone jack.
Yes. And then it's got these like adaptive triggers. It's got new, they're calling it DualSense because it's redesigned haptics. So it should be real subtle and it should feel like you're driving through mud when you drive through mud somehow.
That's exciting. Dieter, you want to yell about the Xbox Game Bar?
I actually don't want to yell. I actually want to give Microsoft a little bit of credit for building something that maybe potentially could make them relevant in desktop gaming. I mean, they make Windows. They are super relevant. It's this overlay, and then they basically like open it up for other people to integrate into their overlay. So instead of having to like have overlays from other games, there's just like now like a standard bar on Windows that like has the chance to be like the default thing that you use to like have an overlay for, like, do other stuff outside of the game. That's really smart. It's really overdue, I think. Of course, they're going to use it to push like Xbox stuff, and so maybe it will completely fail. But yeah, it's a smart idea, and I'm glad they're finally doing it.
There's two ways I can see this going. Right now, like if I launch a game on Windows, there's like three random overlays. Like NVIDIA gets at me, Steam, Discord. They're all happy to be an overlay, and they really want to be my overlay. And I hate that. If they all used Microsoft's API and then Microsoft let me manage overlays better, that would be cool. But I just think this is going to be like the fourth overlay and they're all pop over at once and it'll be annoying.
This is great. And Yahoo's going to have one.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be amazing. Pixel 4a, Dieter?
So the retail box leaked. And we also, 9to5, Google got like pretty solid specs on it. Looks like there's only going to be one version of it. The screen is going to be 5.8 inches. There it is. And, you know, specs are going to be the specs. Looks like a Snap 730. It'll be, you know, it'll be the same thing as last year, basically. It'll have a headphone jack. The bezels are going to be a little bit smaller this year. But again, like, unless Google does something shockingly good with the Pixel 5, the Pixel 4a is like the thing to get. And like the Pixel 5a is going to be the thing to get. Like, they really need to impress us with the 5 because, like, this 4A looks like it's going to be just as the only difference between it and the 4 that matters to like most people in their day-to-day experience is whether or not you want face unlock.
Can I share some personal news about Pixel? The top glass of the back of my Pixel 3 has broken, and it's really sad.
Well, Pixel 4A, all plastic. No wireless charging, probably, but it does have a headphone jack.
Is it unapologetically plastic? And then there's just a bunch of Google messaging links here that, quite frankly, as I stare at them, I just waves of exhaustion are.
Like everybody, Google is putting out a bunch of PR about their video conferencing stuff during the pandemic. And in one of their like notes, they just happened to call it Google Meet. And everyone's like, what the hell is Google Meet? Do you mean Hangouts Meet? And they're like, yeah, that's what we meant. Hangouts Meet, which if you remember is the video version of Hangouts, not Duo, but it's the video conferencing there, is now called Google Meet. And we're like, well, what about Hangouts Chat, which is their Slack competitor? That, it turns out, we're going to have a story. It's going to be called Google Chat, which means officially,
no way,
for the first time in history, there will be a real product called Google Chat. Not Google Talk. Google Talk, by the way, which is what everybody calls GChat, is still around in the form of Hangouts, which is still around for consumers. Google's last communication about that was that it would be end of life in June of 2020. We don't know yet. By the time you read this, we might have an answer.
If I go to hangouts.google.com, I'm still using Hangouts,
yes,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I have to do something special and intriguing to discover Meet.
Right.
Okay. The thing about Meet, which is hilarious, I don't know if you've been on a large Meet call, but it doesn't tile the video by default. It just puts everybody in a stack on the right, and then whoever's talking gets the big window. There are literally Chrome extensions to just solve this problem. Like, just reorganize this window so it looks like Zoom or whatever. Like, the most obvious thing they need to do, they haven't done it. But I love there's an ecosystem of third-party Chrome extensions to do it.
Quote, there will be no changes to the consumer parentheses classic parentheses version of Hangouts.
No. But that's the one they need to change. Like, is the next one like parentheses we know dot dot dot?
No, I've been on so many more Hangouts and it's so bad. Like, you unplug your headphones and then it lowers the volume of everything, but you can't raise the volume back. Like, friends who like just can't get it to work on their computer, probably because they're trying it in Safari, but I use it in Safari and it works. It's just like, it's a nightmare and it's an important infrastructure. Oh, well.
You got to switch them all, man. This is your time to break the network effect.
That's right. We're switching to Matrix.
Yeah. All right, we've gone a little long. That was good. It was like, see, there's all kinds of stuff going on in this world. Dieter's just looking at me.
No, I just turned on GChat again in Gmail for the first time in like a year. And just like, ooh, I'm just looking at it just fondly.
Well, no one's going to talk to Dieter again for some time while he figures out
Google,
his GChat.
Google Hangouts doesn't integrate with Google Calendar. And if I get invited on Google Calendar, it doesn't even show up in Hangouts.
That was the VergeCast, everybody.
Thanks so much for listening.
My thanks to Monica Chen. Julia, as always, wonderful. We'll be back on Tuesday. I can't say who it is. I'm holding out hope for a particular name. I'm excited. Tuesday, we'll have an interview show. I'm back on Friday. We're not going anywhere, so we're just going to keep making podcasts. Let us know if you like them. apologies if you heard the thumping of my daughter running above me today. But it seems to be going well. Let us know about that calibration between virus coverage and tech coverage. It's on my mind. You can tweet at us. I'm at Reckless. Paul's at Future Paul. Dieter is at Backlon. We'll see you soon. Rock and roll.
Paul.
Promo code.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.